Hello, and welcome to Presenting, a podcast where we chat about various topics related to role-playing games, typically Paizo products such as Pathfinder and Starfinder, but also others. I'm John Godick, and with me today is Steve Jackson. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm very, very excited. You know, I'm kind of an old-school gamer, so I remember when Car Wars came out, and I remember especially when GURPS came out. I was very excited about that. So normally I do a relatively quick bio for my guests, but with Steve, I have a lot more to cover, so I'm just going to hit some of the many highlights that he's accomplished as a game designer over the past 40 years. So Steve began designing games 40 years ago, originally with Ogre, and then he incorporated his company, Steve Jackson Games, in 1980. In 1982, Steve Jackson Games released their first big hit, Car Wars, which this year I saw had a successful Kickstarter to publish its sixth edition, and $650,000 was raised. That's crazy. With Kickstarters now, there's so many of them, so that's a huge amount to be able to raise. In 1983, he was elected into the Adventure Gaming Hall of Fame. And even after that, in 1986, Steve Jackson Games launched the award-winning and highly adaptable GURPS franchise, which even today is still going strong with over 1.5 million copies in print. And this doesn't even include the many foreign editions that are out there.
That's right. I should point out here that the count on GURPS is getting less and less relevant as we emphasize PDF more and more. Mm-hmm. It's possible to have a fantastic book that thousands of people are playing with and no copies in print.
Right, right. So these are just print copies that we're talking about here, which is still phenomenal. So in 2001, Steve Jackson Games launched Munchkin, which won the 2001 Origins Award for Best Traditional Card Game. And now Munchkin and its many different expansions and versions now account for the bulk of the company's sales. And I have to say that for Christmas, my daughter actually got me Starfinder Munchkins, which unfortunately, due to the pandemic, I haven't been able to play with anybody yet. So I'm kind of looking forward to that. And on one final note, in the words of one of my friends who happens to be a game developer at a major tabletop gaming company, Steve is gaming aristocracy. So Steve, originally from your bio, it looks like you were interested in politics in law school. How'd you go from that to becoming a game designer?
I made it into law school and discovered that I enjoyed the law, but I did not. It didn't look like the practice of law was going to interest me. The things that I liked most were my courses in legislation, for instance. And about that time, I started working with metagaming, and I found that the contracts and legislation courses had prepared me for rules writing. Mm-hmm. And I've been a gamer for a long time, and now I found out that I could create material as well as play it. Never looked back.
So to what extent did kind of the rule of law help you in the rule of gaming?
Well, that and a little bit of computer programming gave me a very object-oriented approach to rule writing. You define a thing and you use that definition to define other things. And if you've done it right, it should be clear.
So kind of the logic, the logical connections is what really aided you?
Yes, that and the training and making sure that all possibilities are covered. You don't want people coming back and saying, but what if I ABC? You should exhaust the universe of possible actions and consequences.
So you were into programming early on then, if we're looking at this in the 80s.
Oh, I played with it a little bit in high school. There was one computer in the school. Mm. I never became a serious programmer. I wrote one computer game and had fun with it, but I didn't go that way. I went with board games.
Right, but even so, like with metagaming, that where you developed Ogre, that's one of the games that you really pushed into computer gaming, though.
I wouldn't say pushed into, but allowed myself to be dragged along. It was fun. Mm-hmm.
So over the past 40 years, your company has had numerous successes in the gaming industry. And this is an industry that's really full of small, struggling companies, yet you've been kind of a big presence in there. What is it about the approach to game design that you've had that's enabled you to have the success that maybe a lot of others haven't? I mean, a lot of others might have a one shot that's really successful, but after that, you know, they're just kind of a one trick pony. Here you've had 2, 3, 4 big successes over time.
If I knew, I'd bottle it. I have had a lot of releases that have been modest successes or no successes at all. So one of the things is keep trying. And one of them, although this is going to be trite, but give everyone your best shot. Be a perfectionist. I don't know who said it, but it's true. A late game is only late until it comes out, but then it sucks forever. So get it right.
Now, what is your approach for designing games? So, you know, you've had a lot of kind of different games. You know, if we look at early on with Ogre and Car Wars, and then getting into GURPS, which was a complete departure from kind of what was existing at the time, and even now to Munchkins, where it's an even different approach.
And Zombie Dice, which is completely different from those. And we've sold an awful lot of Zombie Dice. I like games. I like playing games, and I like making games. And I don't even have to try not to get into a rut. I have to try not to always be chasing the next idea until I finish the last one.
So where do you get your inspiration? Are you still continuing to play a lot of different games? Or?
Well, not as many now as I would like. Yes, one of the things that I enjoy about going to conventions is new people and new games.
So of the more current games out there, do you have any particular ones that you would like to point to? Is that something that's really cool? I wish I would have done that, or I like how they use a particular mechanic?
Oh, Century is one that I'm recommending to people these days. That's an awful lot of fun. That's not a game I would have designed myself. I don't think that way, but I sure enjoy playing it. And Terraforming Mars is a game that I might have designed myself if I had been so lucky. I do think that way. I've only gotten to play 3 complete games of Terraforming Mars, and I really, really like it. I'd love to meet the designers one day.
Right. So which gaming conventions do you typically attend? Do you go to Origins and Gen Con, or do you stay with smaller ones?
Not every year, but many years I go to Origins and Gen Con. I like the smaller ones, too.
All right. So, Steve, you've been in the tabletop gaming industry for over 40 years. How have you seen it change over those years, and has it been for the better or for the worse?
There's no question but what we are in a golden age for game players. There are more games and better games than ever. It's a very, very competitive industry for game designers. I'm not going to say cutthroat because I'm not aware of any throats getting cut, but it's easy to lose money designing a game. Kickstarter helps with that. It lets you manage your expectations, but it's a great time to be a gamer, and it's an interesting time to be a designer, but you have to run very fast just to stay in the same place.
Well, it seems like it's because there's so many companies developing that it's a very competitive industry on the game developer side, and the margins have really gotten, it seems like, relatively slim compared to when you started. Is that the case?
Margins are maybe a little bit slimmer. Where the margins are really being pressured is at retail because of internet competition.
So one of the things that has been changing of late is that there's this prize of legacy games or board games that kind of save their state from game to game, and you play an ongoing narrative. Now, when you first started, you know, you were one of the people that actually straddled between board games and RPGs early on. What do you think of this relatively new innovation that games like Pandemic Legacy, Risk Legacy, and Gloomhaven have started to bring to the table?
I think they're a great idea. It bugs me a little bit to permanently destroy or alter a game board, but that's just my OCD showing up. It turns a 2-hour game into a 20-hour game that you play in segments. I have never gotten to actually play a legacy game because of time constraints. Can't get the same people together. We almost did a Risk Legacy game in the office last year before the pandemic, but I think it's a great innovation.
Speaking of the pandemic, how has that affected Steve Jackson Games?
We have gone to a work-at-home company. We decided early on that we were not going to do layoffs and crawl into the ground, that everybody who could would work at home and leave the office unoccupied except for the few people who have to go in. And that leaves the office so empty that safe distancing is possible. Mm-hmm. But it's really hurting our playtesting, and it's not doing my creativity any good to be farther away from people and sources of ideas.
Now, what about in terms of sales of your product? You know, with everybody at home, do you see kind of an uptick in kind of demand for tabletop games?
Sales are down overall because people cannot get to the retailers. The evergreen games, the really popular ones, are as strong as ever, maybe in some cases a little bit stronger. But new entries, people have no way to see them, and they're not doing so well. That's got to really be hurting startups.
So, and for the tabletop games, so the importance of the game store outlets where people can test drive games is pretty important then?
Yes. Game stores and conventions. Gaming is a face-to-face hobby.
Yeah, no, I agree. A lot of that. So I play a lot of role-playing games, and for us, the transition to online hasn't been that challenging, but I can see with a traditional board game, unless somebody completely digitizes all the assets, it makes it kind of hard to put it online and still do the same thing.
There are systems that attempt to do that. I still like playing face-to-face.
Oh, I agree. That's, you know, I was a long-time RPG player, and then I went to video games for a while, and I really missed the face-to-face. And so I kind of quit that and got back into playing RPGs just for the face-to-face. And then now we're, of course, in a pandemic where you really can't see anybody. So it's very challenging. So what advice do you have for people interested in getting into designing and developing tabletop games and card games now?
Play as many things as you can. And when you come up with your own ideas, Play test. Play test with different groups. When you think you have something that's really solid, do blind testing, where either you're not there or you're there but under a vow of silence, so you can see what people make of your rules. Your playtest components need to be good enough to be honest, playable representations of your final set. But you don't have to do all your artwork and so on while you're still playtesting. That's a waste of effort.
Now, how much do you playtest games at Steve Jackson Games before you actually bring it to mass production and release?
A lot. It needs to be right, and it needs to be clear. It's not enough if technically all the rules are there if people can't find them. That's why I believe in having an index in a role-playing book, for instance.
Now, Origins and Gen Con, I often see a lot of people in the cafes or sitting down at benches demonstrating the games they're developing for other people and doing playtesting. Is that something you recommend to folks, or do you think you should just do it with your friends a whole bunch and then maybe a broader audience like that?
There's no harm in starting with strangers if you can find strangers who are willing to play. Just take good notes.
And when you look at developing a game, are you looking – you mentioned the importance of clarity of rules and whatnot. How do you balance that with ensuring that it's a really fun game too, you know, so that it's not too complicated, yet the rules are really clear and set and the outcomes are all accounted for, yet it's also maybe a relatively easy to pick up game that's fun for people?
I don't see those as being in conflict. There's more time for fun if the rules are clear and you don't have to spend a lot of time reading them. Clear doesn't have to mean long, and complete doesn't have to mean long. It's just a matter of organization. That gets back to what I learned in law school.
So that kind of suggests a clear, concise, and maybe even a simpler set of rules, or is yes. Complexity still okay?
Complexity is not okay this year. It goes in cycles, and right now, don't be complex.
So why does that change over time?
People get bored with simplicity and want something that makes it a little bit harder. This continues, and then eventually all of a sudden they have too many details and they get sick of hard and want something easier.
So could you have the same offering for kind of both audiences? You know, for example, you see a lot of times you see a beginner box that has a simplified set of rules before they go to the big broader set?
Optional rules are good. Some groups will always read and play all the optional rules immediately, which sabotages the intent. But if they're having fun, that's great.
So in more recently, you've kind of developed Munchkin, which it had previously accounted for the majority of the sales of your company. I don't know what it currently does.
Still does.
Yeah. So the approach seems a little different than your previous titles in that you look like you've done quite a bit of licensing of IP from other companies, you know, both, you know, kind of franchises for games, but also movies and things like that. What led to this change or kind of how did it go from the standalone game to now this kind of this massive collection of different titles?
It went gradually, as many big changes do. It started off with doing Munchkin in different genres, the space game and the vampire game and so on and so on. And I can't even remember what the first licensed one was, but one day somebody said, hey, we could do it for this specific thing. And we were able to get the rights. And now we're working with a company called The Op, which has very, very good licensing connections, and they've done a number of licensed products.
And so that's some forthcoming products that you'll be having?
Well, there are already some out, but there are more forthcoming. There's going to be a Disney Munchkin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw that. And kind of what's driven the appeal of Munchkin with these? Is it a different audience, or is it the same audience looking for something different?
Both. We get both.
And does this differ from your more traditional board game and RPG audience, or is this kind of more the same, do you think?
Not sure I understand the question.
Well, I guess, so when I look at the Munchkin games, it's not something, for me, I hadn't really thought much about them until, like I mentioned previous to getting started here, my daughter gave me a copy of Starfinder Munchkin. And until then, I had no idea what Munchkin was. Ah. And it's like, wow, this is actually really cool. And so I guess what I wonder is the positioning and branding right now, is it geared maybe towards younger people that aren't traditionally into RPGs and tabletop games, or is it maybe still for those folks that are looking for a different outlet?
Again, it's both. You get some people who are attracted to a game because of the license attached with it. A big Disney fan may pick up Disney Munchkin where he never saw any Munchkin game before. Mm-hmm. But it's also variety for people who already play Munchkin, and you can combine the sets. I don't recommend shuffling every one of the 6,000 cards you own into one deck, mm-hmm. but you can make amusing combinations of a few and have a lot of fun with them.
Right. Yeah, I noticed with the Starfinder that your previous Star Munchkin, that's one of the things they recommend. You can intermingle the decks and build something a little bigger.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right, cool. So what's next for you, and what's next for Steve Jackson Games?
Well, most of my attention right now is going to two things. On the role-playing side, it's going to development of Fantasy Trip. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we've got a Kickstarter which closes this afternoon, so people who are listening to this 3 weeks from now missed it. Sorry about that. But there is a backer kit. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And on the board gaming side, I'm working on a new edition of Wiz War, which is an old classic mm-hmm. board game that I have admired for many, many years. We finally picked up the rights to do it. And working playtesting around and through the pandemic has slowed things down, but the game is still moving forward.
So now you mentioned this Kickstarter that you have that's closing. You also did the Kickstarter earlier this year for Car Wars.
Car Wars, yes.
Yeah. So is this this business model of doing a Kickstarter before launching a new edition or a new line, is that something that is kind of necessary in the tabletop gaming industry now in order to kind of prove pre-sales, or is it just something you're just testing out, or kind of where's that fit in your overall business, I guess?
We're happy with Kickstarter as a business model. I mean, you never know what you're going to be doing in 3 years, but Kickstarter has been a good partner.
And is really helped you be successful in these launches? I mean, is it something, did you have to do the Kickstarter in order to go in these directions, or is it something you chose to do in order to help kind of build the brand ahead of time?
More the former.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, because I imagine it's pretty expensive to start in a whole new direction when you're so focused on the operations of your current products.
We worked for years and years on Car Wars. If we were big enough to be divided into divisions, that would have been a division within the company.
How big is your company right now?
We have about 40 people, counting full-time freelancers.
And so do your full-time freelancers and everybody, are they all located in Austin, or are they all over the world?
No. Several in Canada and scattered in other places.
Yeah. Yeah, with the, you know, today's kind of environment and internet, it's really easy to be anywhere and do work now. Though with, I imagine with playtesting, though, you still need people typically face-to-face in the office.
Yes, although we are learning other techniques of playtesting, but it's still a problem.
How do you do it? So how do you playtest now? How are you doing that?
Well, one way is to find a group of people who are already together in the pandemic who want to playtest. Send them the game. Mm-hmm. Another that some companies are using that we haven't adopted yet, but we're working to learn about it, is using some of these online virtual tabletops mm-hmm. and building a playset for the game in virtuality.
And so that's something that you're doing, like transferring art and everything into it, and then...
That's something the publisher would do. We're not doing it yet.
Oh, okay. Right. Got it. Well, it's been really enjoyable chatting with you. Do you have anything else that maybe we should talk about before we're done?
Let's see. We talked about Car Wars. I'm really looking forward to that coming out because it's been such a great effort for so many years. It was our first big hit. I have a lot of fondness for the game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so me too.
The new edition is exciting.
Well, I look forward to that. I saw that the backer kit is still available, I think, for people to buy.
Yes, it is. I don't know when it closes, but it's open at the moment.
Excellent. Well, Steve, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast today. I wish you well, and it's been a real pleasure talking to somebody who designed my games of my childhood and somebody I generally regard as one of my heroes.
Well, thank you very much.